The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the November 4th, 2024 issue of the New Yorker magazine, the books section. What do animals understand about death? The question isn't whether other creatures share our concept of mortality. It's whether any living being truly grasps what it means to die. By Catherine Schultz. The Virginia possum, according to John Smith, that explorer of all things Virginia, hath a head like a swine and a tail like a rat and is of the bigness of a cat. Had Smith looked closer, he might have discovered that it also has opposable thumbs, 50 teeth, more than any other land mammal except the equally improbable giant armadillo, and, if female, 13 nipples, which are arranged like a clock face, with 12 in a circle and one in the middle. These nipples are concealed inside a pouch on its belly because the Virginia possum is a marsupial, the only one native to North America. All of this is strange, but none of it is as strange as the behavior for which this possum is the most famous, playing possum. Contrary to what you might imagine, that does not simply entail curling up and holding still. A possum that is playing possum keels over to one side, its tongue hanging out, its eyes open and unblinking. Saliva drips from its mouth, while its other end leaks urine and feces, together with a putrescent green goop. Its body temperature and heart rate drop, its breathing becomes almost imperceptible, and its tongue turns blue. If, in a fit of sadism or scientific experimentation, you cut off its tail while it is in this state, it will not so much as flinch. Idiomatically, playing possum means pretending to be dead. But what exactly playing possum means to a possum is considerably harder to say. Does the possum have any idea what it means to be dead? To say nothing of what it means to pretend. When it is moved to begin its Oscar-worthy performance, does it know that it is in mortal danger? Does the implacable fact of death have any purchase whatsoever on its possum-y heart? And if it does not, which seems likely given its unusually small brain, what of all the other creatures that feign death? Frogs, snakes, spiders, sharks, swifts. And what of all the other creatures in general? The octopus, the elephant, the great horned owl, the house cat, the giant tortoise, the chimpanzee, who, in all the vast animal kingdom, joins us in having intimations of mortality. That is the animating question of Playing Possum, How Animals Understand Death, published by Princeton, a new book by the Spanish writer Susana Manzo. She is not a biologist or a zoologist. She is a philosopher with a particular interest in the nature of animal minds. And yet, though playing possum parses with sometimes excruciating precision the possible inner states of an entire menagerie of creatures, it is our own intellectual and emotional condition that haunts its pages. How much, the book implicitly asks, can any living being, human or otherwise, truly grasp about what it means to die? The field into which Monceau has ventured in playing possum is known as comparative thanatology, the study of how different species respond to death. This question is not new. Who can say, Charles Darwin mused in The Descent of Man, what cows feel when they surround and stare intently on a dying or dead companion? The discipline, however, is very new. Monceau traces its origins to 2008, when 16 chimpanzees at a rescue center in Cameroon huddled together and watched, in utter, un-chimp-like silence, as a deceased member of their cohort was wheeled away. A photograph of the scene, published in National Geographic the following year, triggered an explosion of sympathy and curiosity, both among the general public and among scientists, psychologists, and philosophers who were interested in ascertaining what exactly those seemingly bereft chimps were feeling. That photo also captured, accidentally, one of the fundamental difficulties with studying what animals understand about death. You have to be there to watch them. In theory, you could conduct all kinds of experiments to help gauge their comprehension, but only if your curiosity is considerably stronger than your moral compass. You could, for instance, present various creatures with decapitated animals that have been stuffed and rigged to move around. You could use hidden speakers to expose mothers to pre-recorded audio of their dead babies. Both experiments have been proposed, although mercifully not performed, overt cruelty and gruesomeness having mostly faded from favor in academic circles. But that leaves comparative thanatology largely reliant on anecdotal evidence, incidents like that of the chimps in Cameroon, witnessed by chance and recorded with varying degrees of accuracy and acuity. Partly as a result of this, and partly because of its emotionally potent subject matter, the field is extremely susceptible to unwarranted anthropomorphic interpretations. Monceau's goal is to clear this haze of subjectivity from the discipline, using the foremost tool of philosophy, logical rigor. To establish whether animals have any concept of death, she says, we must begin by establishing exactly what a concept of death means. Consider, for instance, the behavior of your average ant. If an ant is trapped in sand, its fellow ants will attempt to save its life, pulling on its limbs and digging away at the sand to try to free it. And if an ant dies inside its colony, other ants, acting like tiny insect undertakers, will swiftly remove the body, often taking it to a designated location outside the nest. At first, those behaviors seem to suggest that ants understand death, since they react appropriately to both its imminence and its actuality. But in reality, the ants are only responding to certain chemicals. In the first case, one that serves as a kind of distress call, and in the second, ones emitted by a carcass. If you take a live ant and dab those carcass chemicals on it, as E.O. Wilson did in the 1950s, other ants will treat it as dead and promptly carry it out of the colony, even if the alleged corpse is waving its antennae, resisting its would-be pallbearers, and otherwise displaying every possible sign of life. The ants, in other words, have no concept of death. Their reaction to it is governed solely by instinct. We can recognize such reactions, Monceau explains, because they are automatic, provoked by specific stimuli, and entirely predictable. Each individual ant will always react the same way when confronted with death, and every ant will exhibit the same behavior as its peers. By contrast, animals with a concept of death will react to it in ways that are learned rather than instinctive, not rigidly responsive to specific stimuli, and highly variable. The same individual will react differently to different deaths, and different individuals will react differently to the same death. We should recognize our own species in that sentence. Adult human beings, even the callous, tone-deaf, emotionally immature ones, demonstrate an understanding of death that is remarkable in its sophistication. It incorporates a grasp of, among other things, causality, every death is precipitated by something, universality, all living things must die, personal mortality, that includes us, and unpredictability. Although we know we will die, we can't know exactly when or how. And that's before you get to beliefs about the afterlife and expressions of grief and mourning. Wearing crepe, reciting the Kaddish, writing Hamlet. The fact that we have such an elaborate concept of death has sometimes been used to argue that other animals cannot possibly have one at all, because to do so would require, say, the ability to comprehend annihilation. But that's nonsense, Monceau insists. The question isn't whether animals have anything like a human concept of death. It is whether they have any concept of death at all. A word of warning. You should not pick up Playing Possum expecting a series of heartwarming tales demonstrating the existence of a love stronger than death between animals. If that's the book you want, it was published back in 2013, How Animals Grieve, by the anthropologist Barbara J. King. King makes no claims about whether animals comprehend death, but she does assert that they feel grief because they care about and bond to one another, because of a heart's certainty that another's presence is as necessary as air. In support of this hypothesis, she offers touching accounts of responses to death in every corner of the animal kingdom, from the big-brained megafauna, primates, elephants, whales, to the domesticated crowd-pleasers, cats, dogs, horses, to the completely surprising chickens. Monceau serves up stories like these too, but far more sparsely and with far more scrutiny. And the longer she scrutinizes, the more complicated they seem. Back in 2017, for instance, a female Tonkean macaque known as Evelyn gave birth to her first baby, which died 5 days later. The morning of its death, Eveline refused to eat, instead staying in her enclosure and screaming. After that, she carried the infant's body everywhere, grooming it, licking it, and at one point putting her fingers in its mouth as if to stimulate the suckling reflex. For 17 days, she never even set it down. Evelyn's behavior is not altogether uncommon in the animal kingdom. Many primates, including male ones, have been observed carrying dead babies, albeit typically for only a few hours or days. So have several cetaceans, most famously an orca known as Tahlequah, who, without the primate's advantage of hands, carried her deceased infant on her back continuously for weeks across more than 1,000 miles of the Salish Sea. Occasionally, such behavior is spotted in other species as well. In 2008, in Queensland, Australia, a dingo was observed carrying her deceased pup from place to place for 4 days while tending to its surviving littermates. It is almost impossible to read such accounts and not feel that these animals understand what happened to their babies and are profoundly bereft. But Monceau counsels caution. When primates carry around their dead babies, she tells us, they often do so not tenderly, but carelessly, in their mouths or dangling from one hand, letting the body bang into rocks and trees while they engage in all their ordinary activities, including mating. As for Evelyn, 19 days after her baby died, she began to eat it. When the corpse started to fall apart, she would gnaw on one scrap of it for a while before discarding it in favor of another. This is not the only story in Monceau's book, which takes place at the intersection of love, death, and dinner. We also read about a dog that, following the suicide of its owner, proceeded to eat the dead man's face, even though the man was found less than an hour after death and the dog had plenty of food left in its bowl. This probably strikes you as an appalling violation of a relationship we typically imagine to be based on love and trust. But it is not exceptional. Good data are hard to come by, but estimates suggest that almost a quarter of pet owners who die alone will be partly consumed by their erstwhile animal companions. Taken together, such anecdotes illuminate the limits of what you might call our intuitive thanatology. On hearing that a fellow primate won't let go of her dead baby, we ascribe it to maternal tenderness and piercing grief. On hearing that a dog ate its late owner, we ascribe to it blind appetite and brute indifference. But neither inference is necessarily correct. The primate's behavior could instead suggest a failure to grasp the fact that the baby has died. Far from being inconsolable, maybe the animal in question is just oblivious. More persuasively, maybe it is optimistic, since baby carrying seems to occur only in so-called K-strategists, creatures, including primates and cetaceans, that invest enormous amounts of time and resources into a small number of offspring. For such creatures, it might make sense, no matter how lifeless a baby appears, to hold out for the possibility that it will somehow revive. As for the dog, before you give yours away, consider this. Wild dogs that encounter a carcass generally begin consuming it at the nutrient-rich abdomen, then move on to the limbs. 90% of the time, according to Monceau, they never even bite the face. By contrast, pet dogs go for the face almost 3/4 of the time, only rarely biting the abdomen. Monceau concludes from this that they don't set out to eat their deceased owners, but rather to get them to react, and that they focus on the face because they have always done so, studying it to ascertain their owner's meaning and mood. The moral, Monceau says, is that simply observing an animal's reaction to death cannot, on its own, tell us anything about what that animal is thinking or feeling. The chimp could be clueless and content. The dog could be wild with grief. But if the stories themselves don't make this plain, how can we go about determining what, if anything, a given animal knows about death? To answer that question, Monceau proposes a bare-bones definition of death, the absolute minimum an animal must understand about it in order to understand it at all. In that stripped-down version, death entails the permanent cessation of functions associated with life. Tucked inside that definition are the two ideas she believes an animal must grasp in order to have any concept of death: irreversibility and non-functionality. This schema lends some precision to a subject that is often story-driven and sentimental, and it leads to some fascinating discussions. On the matter of non-functionality, for instance, Monceau begins by pointing out that animals do not need to understand that every function ceases at the moment of death, only that certain salient functions do. Even humans, after all, don't agree on what exactly stops working when we die. Maybe you believe that your late grandmother is watching over you in heaven, and your brother believes that she is moldering away in her grave. But surely he does not believe that you lack a workable concept of death simply because you regard fewer of her functions as having terminated. Similarly, for an animal to understand non-functionality, it need not understand the whole spectrum of capacities that terminate with death, only those it regards as characteristic of living beings. Our friends, the ants, fail this test, since they take for dead a stinky but fully functional fellow ant. Rats fare better, in an interesting way. They, too, will remove the body of a living rat that is dabbed with eau de decay. But, as Monso observes, only if that rat is also anesthetized. That means rats understand something that ants do not, which is that normal motion is incompatible with being dead. Do rats also understand irreversibility? The conventional wisdom says no, on the ground that understanding irreversibility requires engaging in sophisticated reasoning about the future, a capacity that is likely beyond many non-human animals. But does the raven really need to understand nevermore to understand death? Monceau doesn't think so. Knowing that a dead creature won't come back to life, she argues, requires nothing more than being able to reclassify an animate entity as an inanimate one. Categories that are recognized across great swaths of the animal kingdom. Whether or not Monceau is right that animals use this kind of category swapping to understand irreversibility, the evidence that some do understand it is on her side. In 2018, for example, a chimpanzee in Uganda gave birth to an albino baby, a vanishingly rare occurrence in the species. Although chimps typically react to newborns with the doting excitement of Italian grandparents, the albino one provoked terror. Its fellow chimps shrieked the way they do in response to mortal danger, until the group's alpha male snatched the baby from its mother and, aided by others, killed it. The moment the baby died, the attitude of the chimps utterly changed, from panic to curiosity. They sniffed the corpse, inspected it, and stroked its fur, evincing perfect confidence that the object of their terror would not come back to life. Monceau's focus on defining a concept of death helps render stories like this not just interesting, but meaningful, by clarifying what we can infer from them. In this case, that chimps understand irreversibility. But though her approach is often productive, it can also be frustrating. Monceau, in her desire to take nothing for granted, to question every assumption, can leave us feeling as though we're constantly putting off the big questions rather than delving deeper into them. And she does not always take care to distinguish straw men, such as the claim that animals don't have minds, a view that has few, if any, credible proponents today, from serious and substantive disagreement, such as whether possessing a concept of death requires possessing a concept of life. Still, playing possum represents a major contribution to comparative thanatology. The field, throughout its brief history, has mostly focused on apparent instances of intraspecies tenderness, care, and distress in the face of death. Monceau, usefully breaking with that tradition, pays sustained attention to violence and predation in both intra- and inter-species relations. Death, she reminds us, is everywhere in nature, from wildly high rates of intraspecies infanticide, the cause of death of some 20% of hyenas and up to 60% of chimps, to the red in tooth and claw character of the carnivores every meal. For predators, who must constantly act as agents of death in order to survive, each kill is a chance to learn more about death, but so is each failure. One of the clear, if tangential, takeaways from Monceau's book is that predation is a very tough business. If you're ever in a position to bet on a contest between a red-tailed hawk and a gray squirrel, back the squirrel. By one count, it will get away 9 times out of 10. Likewise, your tender heart might side with the antelope, But the lion is the underdog in that competition, losing the vast majority of the time. Because predators face such long odds, they are highly attuned to any potential vulnerabilities in their prey. A study of Alaskan wolves, for instance, found that they struggled to catch healthy caribou, even young ones, often choosing instead to hunt animals that display signs of sickness or injury, or, in Monceau's terms, signs of impaired functionality, which the wolf might successfully turn into the irreversible non-functionality it needs in order to eat. The pressures on predators, in other words, make them excellent candidates for possessing a concept of death. Consider again that possum who is playing possum. Monceau points out that this state is biologically distinct from another condition with which it is often confused, tonic immobility, a kind of freeze-in-place reaction common to many animals facing a threat from which there is no obvious escape. Tonic immobility is extremely useful, both because it can effectively camouflage an animal, since motion is easier to detect than stillness, and because some animals lose interest in prey that doesn't move. But if temporary paralysis would suffice, Monceau asks, why does the possum bother with its far more elaborate display? The usual answer is that playing possum induces disgust in a would-be predator. But nature provides many far simpler ways to do that, as you know if you've ever smelled a skunk. In fact, possums themselves sometimes forego the whole death drama and simply excrete that putrid green goo to ward off an unwelcome animal. What, then, is the point of all the rest? The reduced heart rate, the low body temperature, the blue tongue. The point, Monceau writes, is that the possum is not trying to appear disgusting, but to appear dead, recognizably, incontrovertibly, irreversibly dead. And the only reason it would do that, she argues, is if one or more of its traditional predators understood death. In other words, such an understanding not only exists in nature, but has shaped it. Because some animals can recognize death, others have evolved to mimic it by way of thanatosis. That is an elegant and interesting argument, and one with far-reaching implications. Because thanatosis occurs across so many dramatically different species, Monceau concludes, the concept of death must be widespread in the animal kingdom. Our traditional reluctance to grant this possibility is part of a long-standing, if increasingly untenable, commitment to human exceptionalism. The idea that we are unique among species because we possess countless traits found in no other creatures. Like language, tool use, altruism, and numeracy, a grasp of mortality was long cordoned off as the special, if difficult, birthright of human beings. An animal will never know what it is to die, Rousseau wrote, and knowledge of death and its terrors is one of the first acquisitions which man made in moving away from his animal condition. That claim is wrongheaded in two directions, limiting our understanding not only of other animals, but also of ourselves. One of our many reactions to death, for instance, is the awareness that dead bodies present a threat to our well-being, both as signs that danger might still linger in the area and as sources of pathogens. Accordingly, like ants and rats, we are unconsciously sensitive to necromones, chemicals emitted by corpses, which activate our fight or flight mechanisms. And that is only one way our response to death is likely continuous with that of other creatures. Anyone who has ever been in mortal danger or in the grips of primal grief will recognize the error of Rousseau's claim that knowledge of death and its terrors moves us away from the animal condition. As for limiting our understanding of other animals, sometimes seeing another creature for what it is requires rather than forbids seeing ourselves in it. Although Monceau is appropriately critical of anthropomorphism, she is equally troubled by the opposite impulse. We impoverish our sense of our fellow creatures, she writes, not only when we attribute to them human qualities that they lack, but also when we refuse to attribute to them human qualities that they possess. Or, more precisely, qualities that do not deserve the modifier human in the first place, because they are not uniquely our own. For many species, she argues, the ability to understand death is one such characteristic. The same may well be true of a capacity for grief, although Monceau, with her instinct for caution, treads more lightly here. She is right not to conflate the two qualities, since it is perfectly possible to recognize death without feeling grief, as we humans do when, say, reading the obituary section of the newspaper, just as it is perfectly possible to feel grief in the absence of death, as when your cherished dog runs away, or the love of your life announces that she is leaving you. And Monceau is also right to point out that comparative thanatology has been skewed by searching for evidence of grief, that quintessential human reaction to death, rather than focusing on all the other ways an understanding of death might manifest in the animal kingdom. Thus, the field's relative indifference to the concept of death among predators. Still, it is impossible to read Playing Possum without returning again and again to the question of sorrow and mourning. In its pages, an elephant keeps coming back to the place where its closest companion died, like a widow making a weekly trip to her husband's grave. A dying dolphin is supported by its pod, which forms a raft to hold it up and help it breathe. Two chimpanzees, who were not particularly fond of each other, grow close after both of them suffer the death of their babies. A healthy, young chimp loses first his mother and then his interest in life, refusing to eat and eventually dragging himself off to the place where he last saw her body and dying there too. At some point, the effort to find alternative explanations for such behaviors comes to feel not conscientious, but simply contortionist. The late primatologist Franz de Waal once criticized the kind of hedged scientific language that insists animals have favorite affiliation partners rather than friends, and that chimps display mouth-to-mouth contact rather than kiss. Maybe animals just like each other. Maybe they just grieve. Maybe the focus on behavior misses the undercurrent of emotions that makes all the behavior meaningful, as our own emotions do. There are, I suppose, practical reasons that we hesitate to grant so potent an emotion as grief to animals. To begin with, doing so would oblige us to reckon with how routinely and brutally we humans expose them to peril and slaughter, including from the spread of roads and the loss of habitat, to say nothing of industrial food production. But behind that lurk other, more shadowy motivations. For many of us, our first exposure to death involved an animal. The firefly in the mason jar, the bird beneath the window, the deer beside the highway, the beloved cat gone gaunt with age, curled up stiff below the basement stairs. We ameliorate our sorrow at these deaths, and at all death, by imagining that it is different for animals, that there is some better, wiser way to die, that if we lived closer to the bone of things, we would neither fear the end of life nor grieve it. Thus, our strange relationship to animals and death. We are not sure whether they understand it, and if they do not understand it, We aren't sure whether that makes them lesser than us or luckier. This is a problem as old as Eden. We long to be distinct from the rest of nature, and we long to be more fully part of it. And, of course, when it comes to understanding death, we are distinct. No dolphin will ever perform an autopsy. No dingo will read Heidegger. No macaque will recite a requiem for piano and violin. But who's to say that they don't know things about death that we do not? However sophisticated our own concept of death may be, after all, it is necessarily self-evidently incomplete. If you are devout, death is part of God's plan. But what could be more mysterious than that? If you believe instead that death amounts to the annihilation of consciousness, what could be harder for the mind to fully fathom than its own non-existence? For us, then, as for all species, some part of death will always remain the way it so often feels, unthinkable. Next, from the October 15, 2024 online edition of The New Yorker, do they really believe that stuff? According to a new book, America's Political Derangement Has Psychological Roots, by Joshua Rothman. Over the last couple of months, a neighbor of ours has been upping her sign game. In addition to the usual stuff, law and order, not my president, no legal rights for illegal immigrants, and so on, she's added, Democrats are communists and terrorists. Are you? And the Democratic Party hates America. Do you? Since I am a Democrat, these signs make me mad. But, as a fellow resident, they inspire a different feeling. We are not friends, but I've had nothing but the most pleasant interactions with my neighbor over the years. I doubt that, if she knew anything about my politics, she'd treat me or my family all that differently. I just can't square the extremity of the signs with the normalcy of the person. That sort of dissonance is commonplace now. In parts of the country where everyone is of the same political persuasion, it's possible to think of those on the other side as entirely evil, stupid, or deranged. But in places like the one where I live, where voters are roughly split, there is no avoiding the fact that many ordinary, likable, and reliable people hold opinions that you find not just disagreeable, but disturbing. Where do those opinions come from? And how deep do they go? Should they cause us to reconsider the character of those who hold them? These worrisome questions have been at the center of American life for years. In theory, we should be able to answer them through conversation, by interrogating our zany uncles. We might find out what they really believe. But talking it through doesn't always help. A central roadblock, the psychologist Keith Payne writes, is that people employ flexible reasoning. By conceding here and asserting there, they evade our queries, leading us into mazes of rationalization. Once we're in the maze, it can seem as though these people don't have stable beliefs or don't believe things in the usual way. In Good, Reasonable People, The Psychology Behind America's Dangerous Divide, Payne recounts arguing with his brother, who supported Trump, about whether the 2020 election was stolen. I did not know how I could relate to him if he embraced Trump's lie, Payne recalls. To Payne's great relief, his brother rejected Trump's denialism, writing on Facebook that, by the letter of the law, yes, Biden won. Yet, his brother went on to say, I think there was some malfeasance there in areas. I do. But it can't be proven. Like many people, Payne concludes his brother had arrived at a kind of semi-belief which allowed him both to acknowledge reality and to hold on to the larger feeling that Biden's victory was, deep down, illegitimate. It is tempting to assume that only one's political opponents are this slippery. But flexible reasoning, in Payne's view, is a bipartisan affair. He recalls hearing in the spring of 2020 that Tara Reid, a former Senate aide, had accused Joe Biden of sexual assault. His first thought was entirely partisan. Would this mean 4 more years of Trump? His second thought was that Reid had no evidence. Then he remembered how, during Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation hearings, he himself had argued that claims of sexual assault should be taken seriously even when evidence could not be produced. Eventually, he reasoned that the worst-case scenario would be that we have 2 men, both accused of sexual assault, running for president. This whole thought process, Payne recalls, unfolded over about 10 seconds while I rinsed the coffee pot. What exactly did he think about the allegations? Who knows? The main thing was that I was once again comfortable that I did not need to change my preference or my vote. We expect people to perform mental gymnastics in the political sphere. We call it spin and regard it as normal. Yet sometimes we sense that the people are spinning out of control, or we realize queasily that we are spinning quite a lot ourselves. This adds another turn of the screw to the problem of appalling opinions. We can ask what those opinions suggest about the people who hold them. Or we can wonder how much they, or we, hold rational opinions in the first place. According to Payne, a professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, flexible reasoning is a fundamental part of our mental toolkit. We reason flexibly in all sorts of non-political situations. A young scholar might dread being denied tenure. A girlfriend might fear being dumped. But when disaster strikes, they find ways of reasoning themselves back to happiness, as do we all. Being denied tenure has a way of suddenly illuminating how much better paying and less stressful a non-academic job might be, Payne writes. Getting dumped helps us think, good riddance. We have psychological immune systems, Payne concludes, and they keep us feeling good. Really, they do more than that. They help us maintain a stable sense of who we are. So who are we? Payne argues that although our identities are infinitely variable, we share a psychological bottom line, the conviction that we are good and reasonable people. It's not necessarily true, of course. We treat each other badly, do and say mean things, and repeatedly discover that we've been mistaken, ignorant, careless, or worse. Yet, despite our missteps, we still see ourselves as basically decent. And decades of work in psychology have affirmed that we freely rewrite history to maintain this view. When psychologists convince people that they're wrong about an issue, for instance, those people often later misremember their prior stance, forgetting that they ever thought differently. Our tendency to rewrite the past can annoy our friends and significant others. But its political consequences are far graver. For one thing, our determination to see ourselves as good, reasonable people extends to our tribes. We pledge our strongest loyalties to those groups that can create and sustain our sense of identity as a good and valuable person. Meanwhile, studies have shown that most people are pretty disorganized in their political thinking. Very few of us hold a suite of positions that's intellectually coherent or consistent over time. Payne describes an eye-opening series of experiments conducted in Sweden, Argentina, and the United States, in which researchers surveyed people about a wide range of political topics, asking, for example, about whether a wealth tax was a good idea, or if counterterrorism agencies should be able to monitor citizens' phones. After taking the surveys away, the researchers secretly altered some of the answers that the respondents had given, then handed the surveys back and asked people to explain their views. Those surveyed only noticed that the answers had been changed 22% of the time. Astonishingly, on the majority of switch questions, participants then proceeded to explain why they chose an answer that they had in fact rejected, Payne writes, and the explanations they gave were every bit as sincere and compelling as the explanations they gave to answers that they had actually chosen. We desperately want a stable sense of ourselves, yet our views are profoundly unstable. What this adds up to, Payne argues, is the near total subordination of political discourse to group identities. He writes that most people are winging it, saying and thinking what they need to do in order to preserve the bottom line that they are good and reasonable people, and their group is good and reasonable. What if a group does things that are not good and reasonable? What if, say, its leader encourages people to invade the United States Capitol and overturn an election? And what if that group's opponents say loud and clear that what happened was bad and crazy? In that case, winging it goes into overdrive. The insurrectionist group may even find it necessary to say that the other side are fascist or socialist bent on destroying America, Payne suggests. This is extreme behavior, but it's in keeping with perfectly ordinary mental habits. In fact, Payne insists, it reflects a genuine desire to be good, giving one's zany improvisations the feeling of moral force. In an old comedy sketch by the British duo Mitchell and Webb, two SS officers are standing in a trench, waiting for Russian troops to attack. Hans, one of them says to the other, have you looked at your caps recently? They've got skulls on them. The other officer shakes his head. He doesn't get it. The first officer persists. Are we the baddies? He asks. The two men look around, notice even more skull stuff, a scarf, a mug, and flee. This skit is funny, of course, because it never works that way. In Payne's account, we're far more likely to try seeing ourselves as the good guys. We might accomplish this most efficiently by further dehumanizing those who have accused us of being bad. Also, it is not so easy to walk away from your identity. The group affiliations that necessitate our ad hoc beliefs are often thrust upon us by accidents of history, Payne writes. He points to the experience of Southern whites during and after slavery. Having been born into a group that was perpetrating a heinous crime, many found it almost impossible not to believe that racism was, in some sense, justifiable. Much of good, reasonable people is devoted to America's historical and socioeconomic divisions. How Americans vote can be easily predicted depending on whether they are rural or urban, religious or secular, educated or uneducated, white or non-white. To a degree, it's even possible to predict how you'll vote based on how prevalent slavery was in the county where you live. For Payne, the divisions in our society are baked in, and we don't really choose to belong to one tribe or another. Moreover, whether we are actually good and reasonable people depends on much more than our political opinions. Our lives are wider and deeper than our votes. Still, politics is powerfully magnetic. It's easy and perhaps convenient, to experience it as the central moral arena of our lives, and so to invest extraordinary energy on the tending of our political identities. Paine wants to be clear. He is not saying that politics is an illusion, nor that Democratic and Republican policies are indistinguishable. But the uncomfortable reality we face, he argues, is that psychological drama is of national importance. Journalists and policy experts focus on the issues and our changing views of them. But the reasoning loops we go through are less like the linear thinking of a computer and more like painting, he writes. If something doesn't feel right, you can always go back and change it. News channels and social media are constantly serving up an assortment of arguments to fill your palate. If one combination doesn't work, you can keep mixing and shading until everything feels right. Our pictures alter from day to day, but a troubling status quo is preserved. Some of what Paine describes is familiar. Of course, we're partisan. Obviously, we have blind spots. During the COVID-19 pandemic, the Trump administration used an old public health regulation called Title 42 to expel hundreds of thousands of migrants. Democrats criticized the action vociferously. Yet, when the Biden administration used the same regulation to expel even more people, many overlooked it. Republicans say they want the government out of our lives, but support developments in reproductive health and elsewhere that increase government interference. These inconsistencies are just part of politics. Yet Paine's analysis points to a different, more troubling level of irrationality. In his version of our political life, our deepest and most ineradicable habits of mind push some of us to indulge in radical fantasies about the rest of us. Irrespective of the underlying reality, these fantasies shape our collective life. We need more humanizing because people in our country have been dehumanizing one another a lot, he writes. Democrats call Trump supporters MAGAs. Republicans call Democrats demon rats. And decades of research have found that dehumanizing words and images are a strong predictor that political violence is around the corner. It is possible to blame the intensification of partisanship mainly on external factors, such as the internet, which can, at least in theory, be addressed. But Paine points to internal factors that are even more tenacious. If Paine is correct, then a certain kind of future scenario seems likely. Democrats dream of a time when Republicans turn their backs on Donald Trump and when all of America views him as a baddie. But is this really possible? If there is a path out of our current political hellscape, it may very well involve the cultivation of a vast exculpatory fiction in which the extremities of Trumpism are either forgotten or framed as understandable. Maybe, looking back, it will all be seen as part of some larger and largely innocent semi-mistake, a good faith effort undertaken for decent reasons by people who were ultimately good and reasonable. This fiction will be galling to some people, but deeply reassuring to others. It could be that living with it will be the price we'll have to pay to live with each other. And now, a poem from the November 4th, 2024 issue of The New Yorker, Backbend by Diane Mehta. Clever in the fold, you bend, backbend, uplift clouds, bend again as if the spine, excited to perform, thinks without uncertainty that it is dance itself. Uncertainly, we see grace, fracas, memory. We are always seeking good inversions, chiefly because we know discomfort and want to conquer it. I wonder how it feels, inch by inch, to find the floor and, forsaking safety, leave it. So much your body is meshed in flex and yet yields tougher than softness suggests. But do you ever feel your body is a noose? Do you see my shoulders moving in my seat? I think you must be limber in the heart the way I used to be. You are the opposite of an elegy. I almost look away, thinking we pay for each performance to sit there in our vanishings. Life is cold. The stage is hot. You back bend to eternity, half in air and firmly on your feet. And finally, one more poem from the October 28th, 2024 issue. Meaning of the Word Never by Deborah Garrison. My childhood room, hippie flowered spread folded down at the single pillow. Wood dresser with battered corners, breathing out scents of other rooms. Owlish bedside clock, whose trusting face met mine as it shirred the seconds. Fearsome length of the closet, holding silence, its sliding panels overlapping slightly like sister's and brother window, at whose sill I pressed my case on stars in the night's steep middle. Then, the wee hours, awake in bed, rocking and meditating, strangely blissful loneliness and insomnia, the sound of my own humming and the house ticking, the first tears after the first death. I will never go back there. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.